Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to get to order. Today's Monday, looks like it's March 9th. And welcome to the sauna. I hope you wore your Hawaiian shirts today. While it snows outside, we sweat inside, or outside. We're going to go backwards today. It's a choice of the chairs. Every once in a while we have to shake things up. So we're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 562. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 562 is from the Oregon Law Commission. It clarifies their enabling statutes and makes some revisions. It changes the membership from 13 to 15 members and modifies appointment by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, adds Court of Appeals appointment, adds Circuit Court Judge member appointment, increases the term from 2 to 4 years, codifies current practice, declares emergency effective on passage. We have no revenue impact. There is an explanatory fiscal on your desk. It's indeterminate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We have four people that are signed up, and I'm going to just ask all four of you to come on up together. Hardy, thank you for being here. Wendy, Jeff, and Lane.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly from Dallas, and this morning I'm with you in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission, and I'm pleased to be with you again this morning, first time in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission. Just by way of brief background on the commission itself, and then I think we'll turn it over to former Attorney General Myers to address the particulars of the bill. The Oregon Law Commission, for those of you who don't know, was established by the legislature in 1997 to undertake a continuous program of law reform and law improvement outside of the explicit legislative process. It was something of a reconstitution of what used to be called the Law Improvement Committee, but that had gone dormant, but then again was, as I say, was recreated in 1997 as the Oregon Law Commission. Currently, the commission consists of two members appointed by the Speaker of the House, two members appointed by the President of the Senate, a member appointed by the Governor, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Attorney General, the deans of the three Oregon law schools or their designees, and four members appointed by the Oregon Bar Association. We have been working since 1997, when we actually started late that year, and going on into 1998. Since the very early days of the commission, we have worked in very close partnership and a really rewarding partnership with Willamette University. Willamette actually houses the offices of the commission, employs the staff of the commission. From the state's side, the state contributes funding to the commission, and we receive the invaluable assistance of legislative counsel in our drafting efforts. The Law Commission, over its years, has proposed several legislative measures that have been introduced and acted on. We work through work groups whereby the commission approves projects for law reform. The chair then appoints a work group that usually consists of a couple of law commission members, but then also several volunteer attorneys, judges, and other and law professors and other experts in the particular area. That work group works for a year, maybe 2 years, sometimes longer than that, bringing back a recommendation for legislation to the commission. The commission then reviews that recommendation and then approves or not the bill to go forward for introduction to the legislature. So what you see here today are three bills from the commission, and I'm here just to introduce this first bill, which gets at the structure of the commission. I think Ms. Braun did a good job in summarizing it. Most of it is not substantive. It largely codifies really how the practice has evolved under the initial statute from 1997, which I think has not been amended since it was adopted. So it really is a good opportunity this session to clean this up. I want to thank Senator Bonamici, who sat in as a work group member on the development of this bill, so I know she has particular knowledge and experience in the workings of the commission. And of course, Mr. Chair, your work as a new commissioner on the commission as well. With that, I think I will end my testimony, except to say that I think, again, that the commission has delivered substantial value to the legislative process over the past 12 years now. I know that it's become a body of a task force, a group that the legislature has come to look to, oftentimes asking the commission to take on some pretty difficult tasks, and I think so far our track record on those has been very good. My hope is that Senate Bill 562 will make the commission even more effective, really, again, by aligning our and implementing statute better with current practices, augmenting to some extent our membership, and increasing the terms of members in particular, so that we have greater assurance of continuity in the work that we do. With that, I think I'm going to turn it over to the Attorney General or to...
Sure. I'll say. Thank you, Mr. Chair. members of the committee, my name is Jeff Dobbins. I'm an assistant professor of law at Willamette University College of Law, and since 2007 have been executive director of the Oregon Law Commission. I just wanted to reiterate Lane's points before we turn it over to former Attorney General, and really to emphasize the degree to which the Law Commission, I think, allows the state to get a substantial return on a relatively modest investment. As Lane points out, over the last decade, the Law Commission has generated something upwards of 70 bills that have been proposed to the legislature. More than 60 of those have been adopted in whole or in part during that time. And the other great thing about the Law Commission is that it leverages the work of a large number of individuals throughout the state, not only state employees and elected officials like some of yourselves, but also a number of private attorneys, individuals that aren't attorneys throughout the state. And I think that the bills that you have before you this morning are some good examples of the ways in which the Law Commission can generate a substantial return on a relatively small investment from the state. So with that, I'll thank the committee and turn it over to General Myers.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Hardy Myers. I'm a public member of the commission by virtue of appointment by the governor last month, but for the 11-plus years preceding that, I was an ex officio member of the commission during my tenure as Attorney General. Early in 2008, the Law Commission decided that its own enabling statutes, which were then about 10 years old, 10 or 11 years old, deserved to take a place on the Commission's law improvement agenda. I was asked to chair the work group assigned to the updated examination of those enabling statutes, and Senate Bill 562 is the product of that very careful review and consideration of the enabling statutes. They represent the respectful recommendations of the Commission to the legislature for improvements in that enabling statutory structure that we think will enable the Commission to perform even more effectively the responsibilities that the measure doesn't change, but date back to the beginning of the formation of the Commission in 1997. I, too, would like to add my thanks to you, Chair Przanski, and also to Senator Bonamici, who was then Representative Bonamici, for serving as a member of the work group that produced Senate Bill 562. With that, I'd like to, if I may, Mr. Chair, ask Wendy Johnson, the Deputy Executive Director of the Commission and General Counsel, to concisely review with the committee the specific proposals that we're recommending that you adopt.
That would be great. Wendy, if you could just read it in my eye there. Thank you. Okay.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission, for the record. You have before you Senate Bill 562, and as written testimony, you have an explanatory report from the work group and the commission, as well as a one-page summary of the bill. I think the one-page summary does a great job of highlighting the substantive changes. The bill does include some reorganization of our statutes and moving things like things together and wrong things that were together, putting them in the right place. One of the big changes is that when the commission statute was originally written, the contract was not set up with Willamette University yet, and so many of the duties were assigned to legislative council, and so those duties have been deleted or moved so that they reflect the practice, which is that legislative council provides drafting services, but Willamette University and its staff provides the staffing services. Looking at the specific text of the bill, section one is our membership list, and it's increased from 13 to 15 commissioners. As Chair Shetterly pointed out, you have two members that are appointed by the Senate President and two members that are appointed by the House Speaker. That would continue under this bill. The qualifications of those members, however, would change. Presently, one of those members must be a sitting member at the time of appointment from the respective chamber, and the other can be anyone. This bill would require that the second position be a former or a present legislator as well. We've learned that legislative experience is invaluable to our work, and it's also invaluable when we work to move a bill through the legislature. So that would change those qualifications. Second, with regard to the judicial positions on the commission, presently the Chief Justice serves as an ex officio member of the commission. This bill would also add the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, as well as a circuit court judge or a retired circuit court judge if that judge is a senior judge, meaning they are still working at least part-time. That's significant because the issues that the Supreme Court deals with are different than what the trial court judges and the appellate judges see on a regular basis. And we do receive a number of our requests for law reform from the bench, areas of law that aren't functioning well or are there gaps in the law. And so having another perspective will help. We are concerned about the time that's available for these judges, but we have regularly had sitting judges on our work groups, and we don't think it's going to be a problem. On page two of the bill, it's clearing up who is an ex officio member and who is an appointed member. It was confusing to some folks. It also is expanding the term of those who are appointed members from 2 years to 4 years. As you know, 2 years doesn't really get a new commissioner up to speed. It's one interim in one session, and so expanding it to 4 years will allow a commissioner to be on the commission for at least two regular sessions. Starting on lines 23 through 31 of the bill, on page 2, it clarifies that for a person to be designated by one of those ex officio members, they have to be a part of the same group, if you will. So if it's the chief judge, it must be another court of appeals judge. If it's a dean, it must be someone from the law faculty. So it just clarifies what has been practiced at the commission if a designation has been made, but this puts it into statute. Subsection 9 on the bottom of page 2 clarifies the quorum requirement, which is practiced in Oregon, but it's written differently in many statutes, and this clarifies that it's a majority of the commission is required to do business, and then it's a majority of that quorum to take action, to make an affirmative vote. Section 2 of the bill is sort of the catch-up staggering portion of the bill that allows to keep a staggering of our 15 members of the bill, and also has a grandfather clause in there to allow our present members to continue on if their appointing authorities so choose. Section 3 is the only fiscal portion of the bill, and it actually involves legislative members. For a time, legislative members of our work groups and legislative commissioners would receive per diem mileage for serving on work groups, but then there was a change with the clerk's office, and work group members who were legislators who were not actually appointed by the commission could no longer receive that, and so we had a disparity. And so this language clarifies that a legislator who serves on the commission who's appointed by our chair or appointed by the legislature itself would be treated the same. Section 4 is regarding our meetings. It's allowing the commission to establish its own meeting schedule rather than put in statute a quarterly requirement. Section 5 of the bill puts all of the legislative council's function just in one subsection. It's to provide drafting services. The other portions have been deleted and moved elsewhere to the subject matter of the commission, which is in Section 6. But the legislative council directive no longer reflects reality. Section 6 is a summation of what the commission's work is, which is to conduct law reform, and then it also lists the subject matters that the commission is to look at. At the bottom of Section 6 is a sub 2. That's the Legislative Assembly portion that the Commission does regularly receive directives from the Legislative Assembly to do law reform, and it's just moving it into the same section of what is our subject. And then Section 7 is a regular report, and you'll receive a report during this session of our work to date, as well as our work that we have planned for the future. And Section 8 is sort of our nomenclature. We use the word work group rather than committees, and that is how most of our work is done, and so just cleaning that up. Because our commission keeps changing the terms and expiring and such, it does have an E-clause on it, and that's Section 9. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Before we go to questions, just want to comment the reason you're seeing us move around as much. I've got two or three members are getting ready to pass out from heat.
Yeah.
I've told them that they needed to start drinking more fluids while we're up here, so they may be getting up drinking a lot of water today. We have put in a call in to facilities. They tell us that if they turn off this room, they turn off the whole building.
Right now,
that feel pretty good. All right, so we'll open up for. So yeah, we know that the heat's coming. We're going to start sweating. Questions, Senator Wissa.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. I know the commission does good work, but I'm wondering about the requirement and the wisdom of an emergency clause on this bill. Our budget for this biennium is almost $1 billion upside down. This would require or allow the legislators to be paid for their per diem while they're on during this session. More importantly, if you put two judges on there, how often do you meet? Because this is probably $400 a day for these two judges for their replacement plus their per diem and so forth. The wisdom of doing this between now and July 1st escapes me.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, actually this bill only requires the legislative members to receive a per diem. The judges do not. And so it's only a legislative piece. So if the legislators are already receiving their per diem, they couldn't double unless it was for mileage. And as a practical matter, the Law Commission work groups generally are not meeting, with a couple of exceptions throughout the session. Our work is largely during the interim and then working our bills through the session. So the judges are actually telling us Fridays are great days for them to meet on our juvenile work group, for example, because they aren't working on Friday. So there is no cost.
Legislative Fiscal's report here suggests that the judges would have to be replaced with a temporary judge, and by my math, it comes out to somewhere around $400 a day when they're not on the bench for somebody else to replace them. That was my point.
Oh,
so it's not per diem. It's the substitute judge.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, I think another way. First of all, the commission itself currently meets probably on average of three or four times a year, so that's 4 days probably at the most. Where we're likely to see more activity is in the work group setting, but this bill really won't change practice there because we already have judges serving as work group members, so even though they're not members of the commission. So in that respect, this bill probably won't see an appreciable increase in the total number of judge hours committed. Another thing that we do regularly to accommodate commission members and work group members, and also to try to get good geographical representation in the commission, is that we make our meetings regularly available for attendance by telephone. And I know that has been used before to allow people to stay at their place of work, not spend a day traveling to Salem or Portland, wherever the work group may be meeting. But they work very effectively even by telephone. So I don't think that the fiscal impact of this, even with the addition of two judges to the commission itself, is going to be significant in any respect.
Senator Wilson.
Are the judges that are currently serving on the work groups and so forth, do they have a temporary judge sit in there on the bench when they're doing that at the current time, or do you know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I don't know. Whatever they work out, I think, within their own courts. I would be surprised because, again, a work group meeting typically lasts maybe a couple of hours. And so a judge that would need to be in attendance at his or her court can do that by telephone and save that trip in. So I would be surprised that you would see that kind of need for replacement judges, because again, like I say, the work group meetings themselves typically only last a couple of hours at a time.
I still don't see the point in an emergency clause in this bill.
Other questions, comments?
I think that takes care of this first bill, so thank you very much. If you're going to be up here for the second bill, why don't we just go ahead and stay up here? Because I'm going to go ahead and ask if anyone else wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 562. Not seeing anyone coming forward, I'll close the public hearing on 562. And Council, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on this one.
Okay.
We'll open up a work session on 562 at this time. And the chair will entertain a motion regarding Senate Bill 562.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to pass recommendation for Senate Bill 562.
Senator James Baldwin, Senate Bill 562 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Yes. I am going to follow back down on the fiscal issue between now and when we go to the floor, just to solve my own curiosity here.
That's fine. And other comments?
Well, I would respond, that it's my understanding that the judges who are serving on the work groups do not have substitute judges. And one of the things that we did include is that the circuit court judge could be a retired circuit court judge so that there wouldn't be that loss of work time. Now, there may be an occasion where a judge does get a replacement, but it's my understanding that that's not the practice. So.
Yeah, and my understanding is the same. I know I've actually, this is my second term onto the commission, and over the years that I have served previously and now back on, I know I've actually have used the telephone conference calls in just because of my work schedule. And from the judges I know that are in Lane County, just their current practice, when they're doing these type of commissions or boards, they normally do not get a replacement. They just build it in with the presiding judge that they're going to be need to be at a meeting if they're in attendance at the meeting prior to that day in court, and they just have one less judge to handle matters at that time during that period. So is there any other comments or discussions? Any opposition, knowing with the reservations that Senator Wissett has had?
Just the fiscal.
And also Senator Bonamici, Senator Boquist, who will be following up on the fiscal. Is there any objection? So ordered. And since Senator Bonamici has more sweat equity in this one, the work group, she'll be there, our carrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 562. And now we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 561. And Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 561 is also from the Law Commission. It's the conflict of laws bill. It provides rules for deciding which state's laws apply in tort cases, and it lists issues that are automatically governed by Oregon law, provides guidelines for determining which law should apply when Oregon law does not automatically apply. There's no amendment, there's no revenue impact, and I don't have any information on the fiscal impact yet.
Right. So just for the record, before we take testimony on this one, we will not be able to move this bill even if we wanted to, because we do not have the revenue and we're still waiting on fiscal. So with that, we'll start with our public hearing. Two of the people I have are James Nessinger.
Yes.
And then is it Simon Sinonens?
Yeah.
Sorry. Whoever would like to start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Simeon Simeonidis. I am a statutory member of the Oregon Law Commission, and I have also served as the chair of the working group that drafted this bill. With me is Professor James Nafsiger, who was a co-reporter with myself. The work group consisted of 10 additional members, which included one retired Supreme Court justice, one judge from the Court of Appeals, one trial judge, and five practicing attorneys with a fair balance between defense attorneys, trial lawyers, and lawyers working for the government. This bill will provide rules on how Oregon courts will resolve conflict of laws matters in the area of tort law. And a conflict of laws case is any case in which, for some reason, involves the laws of more than one state or country. It could be that two Oregonians have an accident in California, or the converse, or it could be that the conduct takes place in one state and the injury in another. For about 100 years, until the 1960s, we had one very simple rule for these cases, and it was that all torts would be governed by the law of the place where the injury occurred. That rule proved vastly inadequate, and we had in the United States what has become known since then as the American choice of law revolution. Courts have rebelled against the mechanic nature of this rule, its arbitrary and randomness, and replaced that relatively certain rule with a lot of flexible and malleable approaches which are based on several factors and policies and circumstances. This change was beneficial in many respects, but in one respect it was mostly not beneficial, because as a result of that revolution there is now no certainty. Nobody knows what the applicable law will be. And with Oregon in particular, one astute observer of the conflict scene characterized the Oregon cases on this matter as puzzling, extraordinary, undisciplined, and bewildering. What we thought was necessary was to provide courts with more certainty, but not only courts, but also litigants, so that when a tort occurs that involves the loss of more than one state, the parties and their attorneys will have a fair idea of what law will govern that dispute, so that they have at least one additional incentive to settle the case before going to court. So this bill provides that certainty by providing explicit, specific choice of law rules for several situations, and yet allowing some flexibility through some escape clauses and a general approach that follows them. The bill consists of 14 sections, which can be divided in three parts. The first part is the preliminary sections, definitions, the applicability, and so on. Then the second part provides a list of claims that will be governed by Oregon law. And there you have what you might expect. For example, if the parties do not raise the issue of the applicability of foreign law, or if they agree on the application of Oregon law, or if they fail to assist the court in proving the content of a allegedly applicable foreign law. But then there are also certain actions that involve the interests of Oregon. For example, if an Oregon public body, state or its political subdivisions or other local or other state agencies are sued in Oregon, then Oregon law will govern, unless the Oregon public body wants to opt out of that in the event that the other way, that the foreign law involved in that case is more favorable. Actions against owners of land or buildings or other real estate in Oregon and arising from Oregon, from injury in Oregon. Actions between employers and employees primarily employed in Oregon. Actions for professional malpractice arising from services rendered entirely in Oregon by personnel licensed to perform those services under Oregon law. All of these actions will be governed by Oregon law. So you need not go any further. When as a judge you face one of these cases, or as an attorney you have one of these cases, you know that Oregon law will govern. Then we take on products liability cases, and we provide that if Oregon has a certain combination of contacts, for example, it's the domicile of the victim and the place of the injury, or it's the domicile or the place of injury, but the product was also manufactured or delivered in Oregon and so on, then Oregon law will govern. And there are some escapes, but but the rule is pretty clear and pretty certain. So if your claim falls within this list, then Oregon law will govern. You need not engage in a choice of law analysis. Now, that leaves a lot of other cases, and there we take them by categories. And we say that if in a case that is not governed by Oregon law, both parties are domiciled in one state, and the injury and conduct occur in another, then the law of the common domicile will govern. So if two Oregonians have an accident in California, Oregon law will govern the claims between them, except when the matter is something that involves the rules of the road, traffic rules and so on. The converse will also be true. If they are not the parties are not domiciled in the same state, but both the conduct and the injury occurred in the domicile of one party, either the tortfeasor or the victim, then the law of that state governs. And then it goes on, if they are domiciled in different states and the conduct and the injury occurred in a third state, then the law of that state governs, subject to a small exception, and so on and so forth. So we provide fairly specific rules. There are some exceptions which the party that opposes the application of the law designated by the rule can invoke to get out of it. But the major accomplishment of this bill is that it does provide certainty for courts and litigants, and thereby will save a lot of judicial costs and perhaps restore the citizens' faith in the judicial system. So this is a very general overview of the bill. I know it's a technical subject, but we try to make it as simple as possible. And incidentally, we also provide very detailed commentary that I hope you have before you, which will be made available to the public through the website of the Oregon Law Commission. These comments, in a sense, take the judge and the litigant by the hand, and they tell them, this is how you do it. We even have a table at the very end that maps out all the cases and point to the applicable section and then the law that applies under that section. There is a table on products liability and a table on other cases. There is also what I call a roadmap of how to use this act, you know, divided in three parts and so on. So I think conflicts law will no longer scare people away because now they have something to proceed by. And thank you very much for your attention, and I will be glad to answer any questions.
All right. And did Joe also have comments?
No, I don't at this time. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, thank you. So let me open it up for any questions from all my legal scholars here as to the conference. This is wonderful work, and this really shows the benefit of having the, from my perspective, the Oregon Law Commission, and how we actually have been able to network within the state and getting people who we would consider certified smarts in these areas to actually give us guidance. And it will be something that will help the practitioner, who in turn will help the parties in these litigations to understand exactly how we're going to be handling these type of cases when we have these issues before the Oregon courts. Any other statements or comments? Thank you very much.
If I may add one more point. In the year 2000, Professor Nafziger, working in a similar forum, drafted a similar statute for the law applicable to contracts. It became effective in the year 2002, and it works beautifully. So we have an example. We hope this one will have the same fate.
Well, great. It's nice to have a model to work from, and it sounds like this one actually will fall right in place with the quality of individuals that served on this.
Thank you. Now, I want to thank you for your work and ask, are all the law professors in Oregon going to have to change their conflict of laws curriculum if this bill passes?
It will be easier to teach after this law passes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 561? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 561. As I mentioned before, we are not able to move this bill forward because we do not have all the paperwork that's required for the committee before we actually take action on it. So with that, we're going to go into our next public hearing, which will be on Senate Bill 559.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is another Oregon Law Commission bill. This is this one modifies a requirement for a motion to intervene in juvenile court proceedings. No revenue impact, and it has no fiscal impact and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Wendy. It looks like you're the only one that signed up, if you'll come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel, again for the record. This is our simplest bill of the session from the Law Commission. It really is a three-word bill. The Law Commission has a juvenile code work group that had been chaired by Senator Kate Brown for many years until just this last year. When Commissioner Julie McFarland took her spot on the commission and is continuing that juvenile code work, which has looked at chapters 419A, 419B, and 419C, the juvenile dependency and the juvenile delinquency code. In 2005, the Law Commission recommended a bill that cleaned up the intervener and the limited rights of participation provisions of the juvenile code. And in doing that, A lot of mistakes and cleanup was made in reorganization, but we missed a spot, and it's on page 2 of the bill, in a motion for a person who wants to participate as an intervener. The motion requirements are listed in subsection 4. You have to give your relationship to the child or ward who's on the dependency matter, the reason for the intervention, how the person's intervention is in the best interest, and why the parties cannot adequately present the case. In other words, why your participation as an intervener is needed. That's listed in subsection 4. Then in subsection 5, it's the portion where the court has to have a hearing on this motion, and the court may grant the motion for intervention to allow the person to participate as an intervener. And the two sections don't match up. The Law Commission didn't put that problem in there. It had already been there, but we just missed it in catching all the other mistakes. And so best interest of the child is listed twice in both sub 5, big C, that's line 14, and then again on line 16, it was there. And so we're matching the motion up on sub 4 with the court's findings in sub 5.
Great. Thank you for the explanation. Any questions? Any comments? Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 559? Not seeing anyone, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 559. And Chair will open a work session on Senate Bill 559.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 559 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist, move Senate Bill 559 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry this one. And that will complete our work on Senate Bill 559. So we'll close the work session. And we'll open up our last public hearing for today, Senate Bill 48. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 48, as written, adds persons in grades 12 or below to a list of those incapable of consenting to a sexual act with a school employee or person of authority, adds those persons to the category of victims for rape, sodomy, sexual penetration, and sex abuse. It declares emergency effective on passage. Before us today is the Dash 1 amendment, which replaces the measure in its entirety. The Dash 1 amendment revokes a teaching personal service or administrative license if the person is found by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission by a preponderance of the evidence to have been found guilty of rape, sodomy, sexual penetration, or sex abuse of a student under grade 12 if the person was in a position of authority over the student. It bars reapplication for a license, and the state's records are not exempt from public disclosure. It declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We have no one signed up for public testimony on Senate Bill 48. The Chair will just put on the record that when this bill came to our committee, it was looking at establishing a new criminal law as it would pertain to teachers and their capacity as to having sexual contact or impropriety with a student. On reviewing the text, it appeared to, let's say, one, be redundant to existing criminal law as to individual, whether they're a teacher or not, being held to that standard. But instead, the chair looked at it and asked council to put together, with the work of legislative council, an amendment that would basically prohibit these individuals who have actually been convicted, or if these individuals have been, let's say, going through the administrative law process and either voluntarily stepped down or determined to be engaged in the conduct that's been alleged, that they would no longer be able to have a teaching license within this state, and it's one that goes into perpetuity and does not allow for a
reapplication.
Yeah, reapplication works. A reapp onto the field of teaching in this state. So basically, I think what we want to consider is the decision as to whether or not a person who has been found guilty, or I said has been accused and has stepped down voluntarily, or through the administrative law process, been determined to have committed these acts, to be able to teach in this state in the future. So that's where we're at. I guess at this point, I'm going to ask if there's anyone that's in the room that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 48. Please come forward. And I will tell you that as you've heard, the Dash 1 amendments is really what's before the committee. I know that the bill was originally written differently, but we are not going to entertain the bill as it's written, but the Dash 1s. Aye.
Lansky, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And sorry, I ran in. We worked in a work group for this legislation, and this legislation actually exists in a lot of states. The goal was to deter conduct that we don't see frequently, but that we see frequently enough that the message that it's a crime to engage in sexual conduct with a student, even if they are 18, we thought would go a long way toward derailing what we frequently see as long-term grooming behavior, particularly during a senior year, let's say. A problem we have in these cases is what is called compliant victims. And the young women frequently are not willing to testify against the educator when we're in these situations. I think your proposed amendments would be helpful because it's a step between a conviction of a mandatory crime and the only other thing we can do when we revoke, which is revoke for 1 year. So I think it is still helpful. In all candor, I think that educators who engage in this conduct sort of realize that their license is at risk and that they may be taking it out of the profession, but if we can make that permanent, the commission would support this.
Thank you. That was the thought of the chair and having the amendment drafted that seems to fill a void that we have right now and also make certain individuals know that have to be licensed for this profession, that it's not just a temporary, let's say, revocation of your license, but it would be permanent in the state. Plus, the records are going to stay open in the sense of if someone tries to go to another state, that information is going to be passed along to whatever jurisdiction that they attempt to be licensed in. Any other comments, Senator Bonamici?
I have a question. Perhaps it's either for counsel or the chair or maybe for Vicki. In the original bill, talked about a school employee or a person in a position of authority over the student. And in the Dash 1, it talks about if the action involved a student in grade 12 or below and the person was in a position of authority over the student. So I'm wondering if that was a conscious change. When I read the original bill, I was trying to figure out if this bill applied to a person who was in a position of authority over the student, even if they weren't a school employee. And then I wonder, because adding the and, does that limit it? Does somebody have to show that not only was it a school employee, but it was also somebody who was in a position of authority? So could you have like a teacher from another school who wasn't actually the teacher of the student at issue, and would this apply to them? Is it a two-part test?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I think that that change was inadvertent. I don't think we meant to change that when we wrote the amendment. So
it should be or.
I think it should be or.
Right.
I don't know if anyone else has a different opinion, but I think that's a good catch. Thank you.
No, it would make it clear.
Chair Polanski.
Yes.
Committee, we actually do see cases where educators are engaged in misconduct with students from another school, so the OR would certainly be the most inclusive.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a pretty simple change for us to make. Is there any other comments? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. Ms. Chamberlain, with the current workload, TSPC, how long would it take you to hear and decide a case like this?
Not more than about 3 times a year, if that.
Perhaps you missed a question. Mm-hmm. With your current workload, if a case was brought under this act, how long would it take TSPC to hear that case and to decide it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Pozanski, Senator Witt said I didn't hear you. We're currently resolving cases in less than 180 days. In about 70% of our cases, this would be a high-priority case. It should get resolved, and barring an administrative hearing, of course, it would get to the commission, I would say, in no less than 3 months.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Vicki, thank you very much for coming forward. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 48. Because of the catch Senator Romici brought forward, we're not going to work the bill today. And Council, if you can get that one change done, then we'll bring the bill back for work session. Is there any other comments on this bill before I close the hearing on it? Not seeing any, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 48. And, Council, is there anything else we need to address today?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
All right, everyone, we're going to go ahead and adjourn for today. I expect that we're set for tomorrow morning, Tuesday, at 8:30. And until then, we're adjourned.